All right, this is Doc Pelzel, station supervisor of KFJC FM in Los Altos Hills, and I'm going to be talking to Robert Ballou, who is the primary instigator of KFJC. He was a student at Foothill in the 1950s, and he's going to be talking to us today about what it was like to create KFJC and give everybody an idea of where KFJC came from and what its origins are. Let's start, Bob, by setting the stage and talk about what radio in the 1950s was like. A lot of our listeners weren't around to listen 50 years ago, so you might sort of create the atmosphere by describing what the AM and FM bands were like and what you were walking into.
Sure, I'd be happy to. Well, radio in those days was pretty much dominated by the AM band. FM was around and started to come on strong in the early 1950s. You got to remember that this was the era of hi-fi. Boy, that was a big deal. It was before stereophonic, and focused on long playing 33 and a third RPM records, and there was some tape recordings that were really state-of-the-art stuff in those days. The emphasis with FM was that it allowed for better sound reproduction. That was made possible by modulating the signal frequency instead of the amplitude, and so you could get a much better quality sound with FM than you could with AM. But range was a problem, it still is, because the higher frequency FM signals don't propagate well beyond line of sight. But then, of course, that opened up a lot of spots for low-powered FM stations, because you didn't get over-the-horizon problems like you do with AM. And so the FM band really created a lot of opportunities for more radio stations to exist.
Yeah, and I gather, too, that the audience for FM was pretty low because people were spending all their money purchasing television sets in the 1950s, and so upgrading their radio signal wasn't the highest priority. So FM sort of sat in the background and didn't develop a whole lot during the 50s as far as its audience goes, and it has like maybe, 10% of the audience by the end of the 1950s?
Probably not much more than that. Many of the AM stations created FM outlets to capture more advertising dollars, because then they could sell two radio stations for the price of one. so they were simulcast. They did the same programming on both AM and FM, like KGO, KCBS, KNBC were simulcast. And then there was the classical music stations, because, again, of the high-fidelity component, KDFC, or cultural things, educational cultural kinds of stuff like KPFA did, which were sort of aimed to a market that wasn't the general public, but those who could afford an FM radio because it was pretty expensive, and those who had an ear and a desire for classical music. That kind of was the case until about 1957. And a couple of former Stanford students, I don't know that either of them ever graduated from Stanford, but Jim Gabbert and Gary Gillo. Gabbert was an engineer type, and Gillo was a business major. They founded KPEN. It was a Peninsula-based station in Atherton. And they pioneered a lot of new format with emphasis on the hi-fi and a pretty broad variety of music and shows. Of course, at that time, there were only 9 non-commercial FM stations in the entire state. 7 of them were educational, and 2 of them were subscription at the time we went on the air. So there was a lot of room. There was a lot of room for innovation and improvement on the FM band at that time.
Yeah, the FM at the time was pretty much sort of an uncharted wilderness that was just waiting for people with the right outlook and a little bit of backing to come in and apply for licenses and do something. You mentioned the simulcast, and it's kind of interesting that now we're sort of returning to those days, as with KCBS now, which simulcasts their AM signal on their FM, and a lot of other stations are starting to do that again. As a cost-cutting measure and all that. So it's sort of ironic we're coming full circle in 50 years.
Yeah.
And I noticed you mentioned James Gabbert, whose voice has also returned to his former TV station, Channel 20, and he's doing the IDs again, and they brought back some of his old, you know, having your dog on the logos and that kind of stuff. So a lot of stuff is making a return trip here after many years.
That's quite interesting.
Okay, so there we are in the 1950s, and you've got your choice on the radio, listening either to, well, actually, I guess radio was still recovering from having lost its dominance as a prime medium in the country, because as all of their programming and revenue and performers migrated to TV, that left radio with no audience and no ad revenue, and they had to fill their own programming for a change. They had to figure out what's the cheapest way they could do that. The cheapest way you can fill time on the radio is to have somebody play records. So the music formats started to predominate. So that's what you had pretty much on AM was music formats. And FM, again, like you say, was experimental and some cultural and some classical and just simulcasts of some of the major stations AM. So what does your father have to do with this? In your background, you mentioned that he did some work in radio and actually set a quite a precedent.
Well, that's true. I grew up with electronics in our household. My father was a self-taught ham radio operator, an amateur radio operator. I think he got his first license when he was about 12 years old. After going to school and college and graduating from San Jose State with a geology degree, he ended up as a shipboard radio operator on the USS Hoover and the dollar ship steamship lines. In pre-Pearl Harbor days, and then he moved on shore, and we lived then in San Bruno, California, up the peninsula. And when things got sort of snug with the Japanese in World War II, he got recruited to work on the Manhattan Project over in Berkeley and commuted to Berkeley working with E.O. Lawrence on the cyclotron. And then post-war worked for Heinz and Kaufman and Eitel McCullough, which was known as IMAC, both of North Peninsula companies that developed high-power vacuum tubes for military and broadcast applications. As FM radio and TV became more popular, IMAC turned to developing a metal television tube. All previously had been blown glass, and they've developed a metal encasement with a bonded glass front. But then they also turned to developing a high-power FM radio transmitter. My dad was involved in that, and it was quite a monstrosity. It was a colossal water-cooled thing, and they located the transmitter up on Mount Diablo, KSBR. But it could crank out 50,000 watts raw power from up there, so it covered all of Northern California, because you can see Mount Shasta from up on top of Mount Diablo on a clear day, used to at least. They didn't have any programming. It was just a test station. I think they might have had some news now and then and the weather and a little bit of stuff like that. They had some studios at the IMAC plant in San Bruno. But that was just his introduction into the FM world was in a technical sense.
So it sounds like you had you were sort of growing up in an electronic environment, shall we say. You developed your own interest in radio.
I did. We lived with a relay rack in the dining room, relay rack being a 6-foot-high metal rack with all this amateur home-brewed transmitter and glowing mercury vapor rectifier tubes as my dad cranked out a kilowatt and sent Morse code. The whole room would just glow blue with that sucker moving along. But then I got into Cub Scouts as a kid and built a Catwhisker Galena crystal radio in the Cub Scouts and listened to the Green Hornet and the Lone Ranger and so forth. And then I built a Morse code oscillator in Boy Scouts. I was on the audio-visual crew at the Edgemont Elementary School in San Bruno. As I went on up through school, I got involved in stage crew as a freshman at Cappuccino High School before we moved to Palo Alto when I was a sophomore. And being new in the neighborhood and not knowing anybody, I found some friends in the stage crew at Pali and ended up doing both sound and lighting crew tasks there. I was still involved in scouting, and our scout troop decided to to do electricity merit badge, I guess it was, and talked with the Scoutmaster and talked with my dad. We ended up building a Tesla coil while I was in high school to have on display at the local Scoutorama. It was Tesla coil. I don't know that you or your listeners have an idea what that is, but it's basically a high-frequency transmitter. It puts out a lot of power, and I had no clue as to what frequencies it was operating at, but my dad and I built the darn thing, and I was in the electronics class at Palo Alto High School, and one day went into the lab there and hooked it up to the exterior antenna, powered the thing up, and immediately blacked out KGO with one of my harmonics. And
and how long did that last?
Not too long, because I heard about it real fast.
I'll bet.
We somebody else in the room was tuning around on the AM dial, came across this.
And that wasn't their new and tighter format either.
No, it sure wasn't. The talk show hosts of today would have had a real fit, but got that pulled off real fast.
Great. Well, that certainly was an interesting experiment. Okay, and you had quite a few jobs that related to your interest in radio and electronics.
I did. During the summer, my sophomore junior summer, I worked at the Stanford Radio Science Laboratory. It was a fluke of getting a job there. Had to do with my ties to scouting and my interest in photography, but I ended up working at the Radio Science Lab that summer. And then at the following summer, I landed a job along with several of my classmates at Ampex in Redwood City, where I helped assemble some of the prototypes of the professional video tape recorders, the 3-inch tape recorders that Ampex developed for the professional market. Then the summer of 57, I graduated from high school and loafed around and wasn't really sure what I wanted to do with myself and what I wanted to be when I grew up. And in October, Sputnik went up. I called my former boss, Dr. Bob Helliwell, out at the Radio Science Lab and inquired whether or not with that activity and that happening, whether they would be interested in having any help. He wanted to know when I could come to work. And I said, well, whenever you need me. And he said, be here at noon.
So great. Well.
I ended up assembling and doing the logistics work on getting about 6 International Geophysical Year very low frequency radio data acquisition stations placed in the Western Hemisphere.
That's pretty impressive.
It was a pretty challenging job, and for an 18-year-old kid, I had control of about $1.5 million budget. So it was a growth experience, to say the least.
I was going to say, and that's certainly a lot of money to be responsible for, even especially in that day and age.
Yes.
Okay, well, so after a job or two, you ended up deciding to go to Foothill, which was a brand-new college just opening up?
It indeed was in a great move for the Mid-South Bay Area to have its own college. Without a building, but with the willingness of the people and the area to float a bond issue to build a $10 million campus on a site up in Los Altos Hills, but opened in a revamped, condemned, and converted, I think it was a middle school, may have been an elementary school, at 150 El Camino Real. It really was a Rube Goldberg contraption. It had a steel A-frame framework they had to punch through and put beams underneath the second floor and underneath the roof trusses to make sure it was earthquake-proof, and it had these big exterior metal framework to hold up all these A-frames. Really, it was a weird-looking thing, but it was solid.
Sort of like living in a temporary village of the Army or something, I guess.
Yes.
And exactly where was it? At 150 El Camino Real, isn't there like an El Camino and Grant about?
You know, I don't recall what the cross street was. It was only about 3 blocks south of the main street in Mountain View.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's probably, nowadays, is probably condominiums or something.
Or a shopping strip mall or something, or who knows. Yeah, okay,
yeah.
So I'm sure the building is long gone. And
it was a pretty sight, though. They had some tremendous big old oak trees on it, and They brought in a portable open-sided building that was a snack shack with picnic tables under the oak trees, and the school had the symbol of learning with a wise owl was a plaster owl that sat on the top of the tower in the front of the building. And that owl, of course, became the school mascot.
That's right, and they still have that owl, and I think they've trained him now to give parking tickets out in the lot. So.
Well, there was a time when the communication, the journal of mass communication students had a problem with the student body, student association officers, and we stole the owl one night and held it in ransom for getting our way with something I've long since forgotten what it was.
Well,
it was quite a stunt.
I'm sure it was a harrowing experience for the owl,
indeed.
So that sounds like an interesting insight into student life and the atmosphere at Foothill. Can you tell me a little bit about what it was like to be a student there at that time, and since the college was just opening, and, you know, how many students were there, and what sort of, you know, classes were they, you know, predominantly taking, and this sort of thing?
Yeah, I don't know exactly what the student body count was, but it couldn't have been more than 1,000 total. I think there was only something like 30 or 40 in our graduating class the first year. It wasn't very big. That would be something that the registrar would have to tell you, but it was a great school. We had a lot of spirit because we were new. We had both young and older students, typical of a community college. There were adult night students as well as some adult day students. Excuse me. It was called Foothill College. It would have been called a junior college, but we were trying to get away from there. I think they were trying to get away from that junior college.
They're still trying, yes.
Nomenclature. But the curriculum was designed, as it is today, I think, around community needs. And at the time, of course, the area had not yet become Silicon Valley like it is today, and there was a huge demand for engineers and technicians in that rapidly growing electronics industry. So there were a lot of techies on campus and a lot of enthusiasm.
Yeah, I understand that the sort of paint a picture from the other end, that the president of the college, Cal Flint, insisted that his faculty all be there by 7:30 in the morning and all dressed in their suit and tie.
He was a real taskmaster. And of course, he was there earlier than they were there. And a really great guy. It was interesting that several years ago when my aunt passed away, I found her discharge papers from the Army. She had been a WAC, and they were signed by Calvin Flint.
Interesting, I guess.
At that time was a major, I believe, in the Army.
Oh, good. We can call him Major Flint then. All right.
Yeah. But, it was a good discipline to the campus. And there wasn't a lot of shenanigans allowed. We were pretty straight and narrow in those days, I think.
Okay. Well, so there you are as a student at Foothill. Can you try to place when the first time it occurred to you, or what inspired the thought that maybe there should be a radio station at Foothill, and that you know, you should try to do some research to develop this idea and present it to administration? When did the idea happen?
Well, I think it sort of came about by the fact that we listened to FM radio while we studied a lot. One day I was out at the snack shack under the oak trees and sitting there, and another couple of students, Bob Johnson and Dick Thies, was in September. It was early on in the first year. We were having soft drinks and a hamburger and got to talking about the new campus. The news had broken that this beautiful new campus was going to be built up there in the hills, and how fortunate it was. Future students would be, that too bad we weren't there, and so forth. And boy, they ought to have a radio station like some of the other colleges in the area. And I at the time had in my head, and I think maybe they had gone off the air at the time and then reemerged later, but I recall when we lived in San Bruno that the College of San Mateo had a radio station. And I thought, you know, gosh, if College of San Mateo has a radio station, certainly this new $10 million Foothill College should have one. So we got to sort of stewing over this, and we approached the administration, Dr. Flint and others, about the idea. And they told us that a radio station was planned for the Los Alamos Hills campus, but they hadn't planned on trying to put one here at this temporary location. But if we could acquire the equipment that could be moved to the new campus, they might consider the idea of starting something at the temporary campus if it wouldn't cost too much. And I shared that with my dad, and he directed us to a fellow that he had worked with in the past, Al Eisberg, who I had met when I worked at Ampex. He was an audio engineer, and he's also a radio station design consultant. And so Bob and Dick and I shared our dream with Al, and he offered to help us, which was just very kind of him. So I think it was, I think I have a letter somewhere, I think sometime in October, Al wrote a letter to us telling us that at the time there were only two educational FM stations in the area. One was a KALW at the John O'Connell Vocational School in San Francisco. The other was KSCU at Santa Clara University. He advised us that it would be unwise to build an FM station with less than 250 watts of power and suggested a kilowatt with an antenna with a power gain of a 4. It blew us away. 4-kilowatt radiated power would be plenty powerful to cover the whole Bay Area. But the cost at the time for new equipment, including the a kilowatt transmitter, studio equipment, spare tubes, furniture, et cetera, would be $23,000+. Or if we bought used equipment, we might get it for $20,000+. Both of those numbers were pretty unacceptable to the administration because they were still operating on a pretty small budget.
Well, I got news for you. That number is still unacceptable to administration for the radio station, so not much has changed that way.
So, I can believe that. We went back to the drawing boards, and we scoured the catalogs, and we talked with Eisberg some more, and he said, well, we could probably do a low-powered 10-watt station for around $8,000. So we thought maybe we could get that by, but no, $8,000 was still more than the administration would justify. So panic set in, and we just figured we weren't going to get our radio station after all. And that's when my dad said, well, he and one of our neighbors, Russ Rhodes, could build the antenna, and that he and I could probably build the furniture for the control room. He'd help with doing that, and that changed the dynamic considerably. And we figured out we could probably scrounge some other things if we talked sweetly and kindly to some of the suppliers. And we came up with a proposal of $4,300. And Dr. Flint felt that was doable and took the proposal to the staff with a recommendation that we proceed, and it was accepted. And the proposal was put to the Board of Trustees, one of whom, the chairman, Dr. Bob Smithwick, was also a ham radio operator, and he thought it was a great idea. And so with his enthusiasm and Dr. Flint's encouragement, the proposal was accepted and amended up to $4,500. And that was done by the trustees on November 17th of 58, just a month after we'd received Eisberg's letter. So we were spending a lot of time working on this thing.
And how did that have an effect on your other activities and academic pursuits?
Not a very good one.
Without getting too clinical, you can tell us all you want about your academic pursuits that first semester.
Well, they can't come and get me now, but...
Yeah, the statute of limitations has pretty much expired on anything you want to say here, so short of murder, you can actually, feel free to say what really happened.
Fortunately, there was no murder. I was working evenings at Stanford Radio Science Lab. I was active in scouting as an assistant explorer advisor, so I had some extracurricular things that I was doing, and I really didn't know what I wanted to do in life still. I thought I was supposed to be an engineer like my dad and my older brother, but I wasn't sure, so I tried courses in both engineering and business. Of course, building a radio station wasn't why I went to school, but it soon became the focus of my existence there, and my grades suffered. Toward the end of of my first semester, I received a summons, literally a summons, to Cal Flint's office, and he told me that I was flunking out. I was 11.5 grade points minus. And
rather interesting deficit to have to make up.
Yeah, because that was a few grade points down from where he had to, the college would have to flunk me out. And he was really concerned that I was really the only person around who knew what was going on with the radio station thing. So he had gotten together with the Dean of Instruction and the Dean of Students, and they'd created a new course called Special Electronics Laboratory. And they'd socked me 2 units of A, which brought me up to a minus 9.5, which was a half a grade point above the legal flunk-out level. And then he proceeded to tell me I was going to take mass communications classes in the future.
Well, very, very good then. That shows the solid start that KFJC got out to, because in the last 50 years we've had many people that have, because of their involvement with the station, either flunked out or lost their jobs or gotten divorced or developed illness. So this is, you started a great tradition there with your initial academic pursuits there.
Well, it can be consuming. There's no question about it, but journalism and broadcasting, they did start some broadcasting courses now that they're going to have a radio station, and of course the usual general ed courses followed, and I buckled down on my academics that spring. Of course, I was lousy in formal English classes, but I found a natural talent in journalism, writing to the 11th grade level in those days. I think it's probably lower than that now, but...
Considerably.
I brought my grade levels up, and my grade level up, my GPA up, and was able to stay in school. And I was appointed the station manager at that time.
Okay, and just out of curiosity here, I don't want to jump ahead, but how long were you with the station?
I was with the station basically from the get-go through my third semester, through the end of my first semester, my sophomore year.
Okay, great. Let's go back to the license application. You've talked a little bit about Al Eisberg. He helped you do the application, and then you submitted it to the FCC. What was the process for that like, and how was that road?
Well, it was fairly smooth. Al's experienced in doing these things, and it required a lot of technical knowledge that we didn't have as students, of course. But bless his soul, he did the technical work and submitted the application in December of 1958. So things had moved along pretty fast. We had to gather aerial photographs and put together a proposed program schedule and topographic maps and all sorts of stuff we never thought we'd have to have for an application for a radio station. But Al provided the guidance and helped us through it. The commission had some questions about the frequency we requested. We had originally requested 88.5, and we had originally requested KRFC, Radio Foothill College, for our call letters, and they also questioned our antenna height because of the distance from Moffett Field and the need or not for an airline beacon and whatnot. So those questions went back and forth, and finally we got our approval in February, early February, I guess it was February 3rd, I think, that we received final approval to proceed to build the station. That wasn't to go on the air yet, but to build the station.
And do the tests and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, okay.
All
right, well, that's rather interesting, because the FCC at the time, since they, on one hand, there was a lot more room in the FM band. It wasn't nearly as, compacted and cluttered as it is now. And on the other hand, they weren't quite as used to giving out applications because they weren't quite sure how the whole process worked, because they were inexperienced in it, I guess. And so they were a little bit, I guess, more thorough in certain aspects of the application than they have become nowadays. In fact, nowadays there's a lot of examples of like them accepting applications that have blatant errors in it and then have to be corrected later. So I think they were a lot more fastidious and attentive to detail back then, and actually checking through each application individually. So you're probably under the microscope quite a bit more.
I suspect that was the case, yes.
Okay.
And the call letters, the KRFC was pretty close to KFRC, and I think that's probably why we didn't get...
Well, that did kind of puzzle me also, because KFJC seems a lot more close to KFRC than KRFC does, but then again, I don't work for the government, so...
It's the J and the R problem.
That's true. Well, there we go. Okay. All right, so... once you had the application, I guess parallel to while that was going on, you were designing and building the studios in the Mountain View campus. Can you tell us a little bit about how that worked and some of the issues that happened along the way for that particular part of the process?
Well, we had pretty well scoured the school for a potential location and found a storage closet in the basement that was adjacent to a conference room. And so as soon as we had the FCC go ahead, we began the process of selecting the equipment we wanted. And we ordered and received a significant number of things, discounts and donations from a number of companies there, Car Engineering in Palo Alto, and the James S. Heaton Company that were representing Weathers Industries, which were really state-of-the-art FM tone arms, James B. Lansing for our speakers and microphones and all the equipment. We got nearly all the equipment for something that, like, wholesale prices. The community was really supportive. And so then we, as soon as we had that go-ahead from the FCC, we turned our attention to remodeling those basement rooms, and we installed a ventilation fan and put sound dampening on the walls and some carpet on the floor, and installed a window between the control room and the adjacent conference room, which was also served as a studio. And by April, we had that pretty well wrapped up. Also, sort of lost Bob Johnson and Dick Thies. They were engineering students and had pretty well lost interest in the project when it was decided the station was not going to be under the aegis of the engineering department, but under Mass Communications. One of the things that the college did, that Cal Flint and Irvin Harlacher, who was chairman of the Mass Communications Division at the time, had done, was they consulted with Dr. Wiley out at Willie out at Stanford, who was a Mass Communications professor out there. And because the Stanford station had problems with engineers tweaking their carrier cable transmitters and so forth and getting in trouble with the FCC, the Foothill staff decided that the radio station would be a Mass Communications function, not an engineering toy. And so it fell under that. So I lost Bob and Dick about that time. And then final exams came along, and thanks to those Mass Communication classes, I was able to get my GPA up and stay in school. During the summer and late spring and summer, I sought out and received donations for more components, including the Ampex tape recorder. We had a little Ampex 600. It was a suitcase tape recorder, something else. Got an HP on-air monitor from Hewlett-Packard, and we set about building the antenna.
Yeah, maybe you could talk a little bit about the process of actually having to build the tower and put the antenna on it and all that, and what was that like, and what kind of resources did you have to pull into play to get the antenna up?
Well, the antenna was a home design thing that my dad and Al Eisberg designed. It was a four-bay turnstile antenna, which gave us a 360-degree radiation, so we could cover as far and as wide as we could from that location in Mountain View. Unfortunately, there was a delay in getting the materials until August to build the antenna. The tower was simply a triangular grid tower, simple structure, and it was not all that high. It was only a 40-foot tower. Then the antenna stuck up out the top of that. But my dad and a neighbor of ours, as I mentioned, Russ Rhodes, was a welder, and so they built this four-bay turnstile that gave us an effective radiated power of 36 watts from a little 10-watt transmitter by doing that. So that was kind of cool. Of course, putting the antenna on the roof was a hassle. This two-story school building had a very steep-pitched roof. It was slippery, and it was dangerous to be up there. And I suppose today the federal agency, what is it, that's overseas?
The FAA, maybe?
Well, not the FAA, but the safety people. I can't remember.
Oh, right, yeah. That's
another one of those agencies would have had a hissy fit if they'd known that we were all up there without ropes around our waist and somebody holding and making sure that we couldn't fall off. But we did it anyway, and we got my evening student, Roy Ruth, who was my program manager, and Roger Murray was my traffic manager, and a couple of other students, Nate Ballard and Jim Fernbaugh, and my dad and I, when we got using a gin pole, we got the thing erected on top of the little platform that was built to sit on the on the crown of the roof, and got it all up without anybody falling or hurting themselves.
So you actually you had to like raise up the antenna and then also climb up to the top and attach the antenna to the tower.
Yes, the antenna was mounted in the tower when we raised it, which made it quite heavy, but then just making sure everything was secure and attaching the guy wires, making sure that all the guy wires were attached properly, I had to climb to the top of the bloody thing and make sure that the light was working once we got it up, because we did have to put an aviation beacon on it.
Oh, that's interesting, because up at our current location, because of where we are, we're not quite exactly at the crest of Black Mountain. We're just a little bit below it. So even though we have about a 70-foot antenna, we don't have to put a light bulb on top, which is actually a very good thing, because the fines for having your light bulb go out are quite exorbitant. So we're lucky not to have to put one up there.
Indeed.
What was the view like when you climbed up to the top of the tower there? Were you looking around to see how far could you see, and what was the view like?
Well, there wasn't any high-rise buildings that blocked our view. I mean, I could see Moffett Field quite clearly, and of course, see out to the mountains to the west and to the north. Nothing really blocking our view, other than there were some eucalyptus trees that were pretty close to being as high as the antenna. We couldn't very well top the trees.
Yeah, that's true. Los Altos and the Mountain View area had a lot more orange groves and eucalyptus trees and things like that back in the 50s.
Oh, yes.
And a lot fewer freeways and a lot fewer high-rise buildings.
Indeed, yeah.
A lot fewer condos. Okay, now, so the transmitter is up. What kind of coverage did you get for your 36 watts of effective radiated power?
Well, we actually did pretty well. We sent some people out with FM receivers to see how far and wide we could be heard, and got results back that we were certainly covering the district okay, the Foothill College District. That wasn't a problem. We were only, the top of the antenna is only 216 feet above sea level, only 100 feet above El Camino Real, so we didn't have a lot of height working for us. But we were getting reasonable signal strength. I'm not sure what our milliwatt per meter kind of
contours were,
readings were, but it was it was satisfactory and adequate for us at that point in time. Anyway, we would have loved to have been up on the mountain, but that just wasn't in the cards.
Well, and with relatively few other stations in the non-commercial band, you didn't have to worry so much about the adjacent channels being interfered with. You had pretty much the ground to yourself, I guess.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, there were just a few others there.
Okay. What kind of test broadcast did you do to have the people with the FM receivers measure you? What sort of programming did you do?
Well, we did just played a few records and did voice kinds of things. We had a tape recorder with sort of a test frequency range stuff, you know, just running at 20 cycles to 30 kilocycle. Well, no, we don't call that anymore. We kilohertz.
Yes.
Tones kinds of things, just seeing how the transmitter and all the equipment performed at the various frequency ranges. And we had some test records. We had some sound effects records. All these things were done in the middle of the night, of course. We weren't on the air doing testing when anybody would have found us. Didn't know we were there.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. That sometimes the midnight wire and testing service sometimes is the most efficient way to do things. Now the library that you assembled for the station, there was about 360 some records.
Yes. Yeah. Eventually, that's mostly classical show tunes, documentaries, jazz. As I mentioned, some pretty awesome sound effects records. Of course, everything was in the quote hi-fi kind of things that was so popular for the FM market at the time, was to emphasize the high fidelity part of it. And Gabbert and company at KPEN were doing programs, and I think it was at 10 o'clock at night, 10 to midnight, Jim did Excursions in Sound, I think he called it, which was just a riot, because he played the 1812 Overture and stuff like that. You know?
But
people could blow their speakers out with.
Now, was he doing his in stereo, or was he still in mono at the time?
He was in mono at the time, yeah. Everybody was in monophonic at the time.
Right, so this is before the little tuners had those little red lights on that used to indicate when a stereo station was tuned in.
Yes.
And I assume those red lights are probably come and gone. I don't think modern-day tuners bother with those. They just assume that that everybody's going to be at least in stereo, if not in HD or worse.
Right.
Okay, so let's talk about some of some of the difficulties you might have run into during the whole process here with either delays of constructions or license. Are there any ones that we missed or that you want to emphasize?
Well, I think I hit on most of them other than the time that not long before we went on the air, we had all of our record library there in the control room, and I don't recall what the event was at the school, but the waste pipes and the water pipes in the school, the main water pipes came right through the control room, and it was always a concern that we would be on air when a lot of flushing was going on and the water would rush in the pipes. But there was some sort of an event, and I just can't remember what it was, but apparently everybody got out of class or something at the same time, and they'd all had too much to drink beforehand, and the system that controlled the water flow overloaded, and we got soaked. The record library was soaked to the hilt. And so I don't know if any of those albums are still around, but if you were to find them today, they would all have wrinkled covers, and we had records scattered all over the control room and heaters in there trying to dry out the record covers and so forth. Didn't hurt the vinyls, of course, but it sure did damage to all the jackets on the records.
So, wow, be too specific. How many gallons of water, or how many inches deep? Well, is there any way you can describe the magnitude of this flood? I'm sure it wasn't just a little trickle. You know,
it was not a trickle. I think we probably had, if we had been there and seen it at one time, it probably was an inch or two deep in the control room. It wasn't any higher than that, but it just came down through the record library.
Okay, well, then we again, you're starting off in a very predictive way here for the station, because in the 1980s we also had a flood in our record library that got to be about 2 inches deep, and the whole floor down there was covered in water that way, and we had people who would make little paper sailboats and throw them, and some people would throw pennies in making a wishing well, and it took quite a while to figure out how to fix that problem. So you were sort of predicting the future of the station with your flood there of the music library.
Well, we can only hope that history doesn't repeat itself too often.
Well, I was going to say, something to look forward to in the next 50 years, I hope not. You got quite a bit of press coverage for the station, and a lot of it was in the newspapers. Were there any other coverage in other media, or was it mainly newspaper that you got coverage in?
I don't think there was any radio coverage. The College News Bureau did a pretty good job of and, of course, we were, as students, involved in that. So at that point in time, I was deeply involved in journalism courses, and I was in the Student News Bureau. So lots of press releases went out about the radio station.
I was going to say, so you had your hand in the actual, you know, creating the media awareness of the station and doing the publicity for it. Yes, indeed. Very good, because you need to have listeners know that it's there so they'll know to tune in. Of the press coverage you got, what did you think of the accuracy of the coverage? I know a lot of times when people are covered by the media, their version of what happened doesn't have a whole lot of correlation with the way the story comes out. How did you feel about the coverage you got?
I think overall it was pretty accurate. I don't believe we ever had a reporter we were getting started. We never had a reporter come to the campus and do an interview or anything. It was all based on press releases that we wrote, so that was the information they had to work with. There may have been some confirmation calls handled by staff that I wasn't aware of, but I think we had good coverage.
And you provided the photographs that they used on the articles that had them?
Yes, yeah, our journalism department our photographer for the Sentinel took pictures and sent them out with.
Okay, so there you are. You're you got everything ready, and I got the antenna up, and you got the test broadcast made, and the records are dried out, and you've got your initial planning. What kind of programming were you planning on having, and what sort of schedule did you intend to operate?
Well, our proposal to the FCC contained a proposed schedule that included music primarily, with some documentary educational kinds of things tucked in around the corners. We didn't really have, you've got to remember that in the beginning, KFJC was designed to be a laboratory for future broadcasters following the current formats on commercial radio. So we would have a sign on at like 7 o'clock, and then we'd have some classical music for an hour or so, and then we'd have an hour and a half or two of study music, just background music, elevator music, if you will. Then for a half an hour, we had a thing called Musical Mania, which was our answer to Jim Gabbert's Adventures in Sound, or whatever you called it. And then we'd have a short news broadcast and sign off at 10 o'clock. It was pretty bland compared to today's programming on KFJC.
Well, given what you had to work with and given what everybody else was doing, actually, it was, in a way, pretty progressive because nobody else was there yet. So you were still leading the pack and doing things that would be eventually become sort of the standard for college radio for a while until it sort of evolved along with commercial radio. So you were still ahead of the game, I think, as far as what stations were doing.
Yeah, we did. I think so. That was the Monday night format. Tuesday night we did a musical holiday. We did folk music from around the world. We did a night at the opera, which was an hour and a half thing. Then we did some jazz. We did organ in the realm, organ music, both pipe and electronic, theater and church music. Again, study music, Thursday evening series were lectures and concerts given at the local area that we recorded and broadcast, or broadcast live if we could. We didn't have much capability of broadcasting live at the time, but we had projected we might.
And I bet you that projection came true. We've now done broadcasts from all over the Bay Area, from all over the U.S., from England, from Japan, right, from the Netherlands. So, yeah, we can broadcast live now.
Isn't it great?
Yeah, it is, and it's, well, what can I say? It certainly expanded our abilities to bring different types of sound that other stations aren't aware of or involved with.
Right.
Let's go back, though, a little bit here. I'm getting ahead of myself. Back to the beginning when it's the everything's been approved, all the equipment's ready, you're about to sign on, it's getting up close to the 8 o'clock sign-on of that first night of October 20th, 1959. What are your thoughts? What are you feeling? What's the mood and atmosphere around the studio? Is it hectic? Is it calm? Describe sort of the environment that you were in as you were ready to sign on.
Oh, boy. There was a certain degree of panic, I suppose, or anxiety. We had rehearsed. We had tested everything. We had tape-recorded welcoming comments from the Board of Trustees, from Dr. Smithwick and from Dr. Flint. I think Dr. DeHart, the Dean of Students, was on hand. I'm not sure Dr. Siemens was there, but of course Irv Harlecker from the Mass Communications Department head was there. Fred Critchfield, our broadcast instructor, was there. It was an exciting time. The staff was assembled, and we turned on the filaments on the transmitter, warmed up the transmitter, and got it all ready to go before we hit the high power switch. And we had everything, all of the basic sign-on was on tape with the national anthem and all the rest. And the Ampex 600, it's an interesting tape machine. It had a lever switch that you flicked over to from stop to play, and if you wanted to record, you pushed a button in, and then it went on over into the record position. My recollection is that in my state of being at the time, we had been recording everything, and I reached up there and pushed that button in and put it right over to record and wiped out the national anthem before I realized what was going on, or parts of it at least.
Gee, be careful. That's you could be arrested for that nowadays, at least under the previous administration.
Well, I realized, of course, because we were listening to the on-air monitor, what I had done just within a second or two of processing what was wrong here.
Did you have any problem with those old types of levers in having to worry about the ka-chunk as you actually flipped the lever into its different position and having that noise go out over the air?
No, it was pretty quiet, but it was just a moment of panic, and I believe what we did was to stop it and ignored that and then just came on live and it said, "Good evening, this is KFJC, Foothill College Radio, welcoming you to our first broadcast," or something to that effect. I may, as I indicated, I may have a tape of the sign-on in. I'm not sure if I do and in what kind of shape it's in, but if I should happen to find it in my collection of stuff, I will be sure to bring it along in October.
Okay, great. And if we need any kind of either baking or other type of restoration, we'll see what we can arrange to do with that. Okay, well, that sounds great. You got launched, and you were there. You were going on the air. What kind of reaction did you get? Did the studio have a phone for listeners to call in, or how did you gauge reaction, or were you aware of what audience was there?
Nope, we were oblivious to whether there was anybody there or not.
Well, that's actually not too far out of track, also, because a lot of our DJs are pretty oblivious too. So,
well, the student newspaper people were there, and they wrote a nice article in the following issue of the Sentinel about our signing on and all these good things. And we got a nice Dr. Wiley from Stanford sent us a telegram. He said, "Congratulations on the opening of America's newest radio station. This represents an important milestone in the development of your progressive college with the support and administration and students. And with the guidance of Critchfield and Ballou, you have an instrument of communication unsurpassed by any school in the Bay Area. I'll be listening with the best wishes for success. George Willie."
Okay, well, there you go. All right. And a telegram, no less.
Yeah, it was a telegram.
Yeah, later on we can explain to our audience what a telegram is. We'll have to define that for them here. They,
yeah.
they want to know, did you put it on Twitter? You know, I mean, was it up on your Facebook? You know.
Yeah, unfortunately we didn't. Well, maybe it was fortunately. We didn't have it.
Now, what kind of a staff did the initial station have? How many people were involved, and what kind of positions were there, and were they connected with broadcast classes, or what was the staff like then?
Yeah, everybody that was on the staff took broadcast class, took broadcast 101 or whatever it was. Had to do that just to know and to get their on-air federal communications license and be able to flip the transmitter on if need be. We had a program manager, we had a traffic manager, myself a station manager, or just the three positions, and Fred Critchfield was our staff advisor. We had about five or six DJs the first semester that we were on. Bruce Wendler was who followed me as a station manager, was a DJ. We had a number of people. I'm still working on trying to find some of those that might still be in the area to see if they would like to join us on October 20th of this year to celebrate the 50th.
Okay, excellent. That's great.
But it was a congenial group, we had our times where we would sit as a staff and discuss programming and who was going to do what. But we weren't highly structured.
And as the station, you know, developed and evolved, did the daily operations change? Did you add more staff members? Did you start doing like more news broadcasts, or what sort of expansion were you around for?
Well, I wasn't station manager all that long. because we went on the air, as we know, October 20th, and I was just station manager the balance of that semester. But the station did add staff and did expand its programming as more experienced people came along and more students were going through the broadcast class and were able to participate. I think that the programming content didn't change all that much. There were more people to deliver it, but I don't think that that it changed that much. And then after I graduated from Foothill, I went to South America for a year and a half for Stanford and for the Radio Science Lab. Again, when I came back, I went to San Jose State, and I sort of lost touch other than to I did go to summer school when I returned from South America to get back in the habit of study. The campus had been moved by that time up to foot to Los Altos Hills, and I'd drop in now and then and say hello to folks, but I wasn't involved in the radio station at all.
I see. So the move then from the Mountain View campus up to the Foothill campus, you weren't involved in the design or the construction or any of that aspect of it. Okay. So you just got it launched and then let the rocket pilot steer from there, huh?
About that, yep.
Okay. Well, and then once you came back from South America, what did you do after that, just out of curiosity? Where did you end up or what was your path?
Well, my path was well-started into journalism and I had been active in the Boy Scouts of America as a youth and as a young adult leader. I went to San Jose State, majored in public relations, and worked in public relations as an intern during my junior-senior summer in Palo Alto with a public relations consultant that was well-known in the Bay Area and did work with many of the startup companies in the electronics field there in Palo Alto, Mountain View, and so forth. I worked with him on the Western Electronics Show and Convention that summer that was in San Francisco. But when time came to make a decision as to what I wanted to do when I graduated, I ended up going to work for the Boy Scouts and did so in multiple positions from local to regional to national staff over a period of 22 years. After moving from the Bay Area to Southern California to New Jersey to Minnesota to Houston, Texas, and back to the Bay Area and to Sacramento, and having been married and having a family and needing to settle down someplace, I left scouting and ended up doing public relations and fundraising consulting to nonprofit organizations in the housing field, rehabbing neighborhoods in inner cities and so forth. Helped them raise several million dollars in the Western United States, and then I ended up back where I started almost as the executive director of the Pacific Crest Trail Association in 1996, and built that organization from 800 members to about 4,000 members before retiring in 2001.
Well, it sounds like you've had a pretty illustrious and successful career in different areas and have had a lot of people reap the benefits of your efforts, as I know they have from the last 50 years of KFJC broadcasts and hopefully for at least the next 50. Any final thoughts, Bob, about the station or your role with it or broadcasting in general or the economic situation, anything you like? Any final thoughts?
Well, I am just delighted that KFJC has been a success and has received the honors it has. I thank you, Doc, for keeping me posted and periodically updated on the things that are going on. It's nice to know that I had something to do with getting the thing off the ground, and so to speak, and that it continues to thrive, and students, young and old, are getting the opportunity to learn about broadcasting and participate in it. It's an exciting career, and even though I did not end up in it, it was fun to take on that challenge and help Foothill College have its radio station in those days.
Okay, well, Bob, that's been a most insightful interview, and if you think of other things that you would like to mention, we can either, we can have a future, follow-up. And also we'll be having our live conversation on the air, which we'll do some of this kind of material, which will be on the 20th, right before the 8 o'clock time, when we'll have you re-sign us on for our next 50 years.
Well, that'll be an honor.
So I want to thank you for all the effort and time you put in, both currently to chase back into your files and pull out all this stuff, and also for your initial efforts to get KFJC successfully launched and operating 50 years ago.
Well, thank you very much, Doc. I appreciate that, and look forward to seeing you and the current staff, as well as hopefully some of the former staff on October 20th.
Okay, very good. I'll sign us off now and talk to you in the future.
Good enough.
Okay. Thank you, Bob. Bye-bye.
Thank you.